Okay, we're continuing along in our discussion of the Eagle HaZahav of the Golden Calf. We learned last time, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the defense of Aaron and whether or not he was punished or not. Today I'd like to talk about another kind of defense that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is about to embark upon, which is you only think of the Chet HaEgel, you only think of the Golden Calf as a sin, because you relate it to your own worldview. But had you had the same worldview as the Jewish people had in the times of that period, you would not be so critical. That's essentially the line of reasoning, and I'd like us to read it inside, and then we're going to learn a story about this from the Gemara. So we're on the bottom of page 115. Bottom of page 115, subparagraph 8, which starts from the words, this sin. We need a reader for today. We need a volunteer. Who wants to be our reader? Sure. Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
This sin was not a departure from worshiping the God who took them out of Egypt. Rather, it was a revolt against a fraction of his commandments. For God had commanded them not to make images representing him, and they proceeded to make an image. They should have continued waiting instead of relying on their own intellects and making something to concentrate upon and follow. Nor should they have built an altar and offered sacrifices on it. They were motivated by the seers and astrologers among them, who thought that their actions were based on logic and were therefore highly accurate.
Okay, so you see that he's taking the approach is that what we had seen before, that the worship of the golden calf for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is not a rebellion against God, but rather what the Jewish people feel is a preferred way of worshiping Hashem. Even though God told them in one of the Ten Commandments that you shall have no graven images before me, they felt that they could justify, they could sort of basically say, okay, we'll disregard one of the commandments, but the benefit of disregarding the one commandment will be that we'll become closer to Hashem. And so their argument was, of course, that the ends justify the means. That really is in and of itself why Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi spends so much time dwelling on the golden calf. Because the whole objective of, you know, the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's worldview on what the mitzvahs of Hashem are is that this is a very highly structured religion based upon God's knowledge of what makes this world tick, what the physical world is all about. And if only Hashem knows what this world is about and what buttons need to be pushed in order for the cosmic juices of this universe to flow properly. So if he tells you to do a mitzvah in a specific way, then you don't have the liberty to alter those instructions because you don't have the same knowledge that Hashem has. And the golden calf is a perfect example of how the Jewish people went precisely against that principle. They felt that the ends justify the means. They said it is acceptable to disregard the specific instructions if we will be satisfying the ultimate objective, which is closeness to Hashem. And therefore, he says, this was not a rebellion against Hashem, but it was a disregarding of one of his commandments because they felt that the ends justify the means. And remember, let's go back to the original dream of the Khazar king. The way that we started this book was about an angel who comes to the Khazar king and tells him, your intentions are desirable, but not your deeds. Which means that no matter what your objective is, if you don't follow a specific set of physical instructions to reach Hashem, you'll never be able to reach Him using your own logic, using your own rationality in order to arrive at the proper approach. That's really what all of Sefer HaKuzari is about in a nutshell. And now you understand why the golden calf is the prime example of how a Jew is not supposed to behave, using that principle as the primary principle within Judaism for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. So this is what he's saying. He's saying they weren't rebelling against Hashem. They just felt that it was acceptable to disregard a particular mitzvah in order to reach their ultimate goal of closeness to Hashem. They followed the seers and astrologers among them. Remember, we talked about why a calf astrologically made the most sense. If you're trying to display a god that is the defeater of Egypt, Egypt represents the ram, Aries, and therefore if you want to show the god who can defeat Aries, you go to the next sign of the zodiac, which is Taurus, the bull, and therefore you create a calf, which is the child of Taurus, and that shows the sort of the god of the Jews who defeats Egypt, and that was what the seers and astrologers had told them to do. Continue, please. But in reality,
they were like the fool we mentioned above, who entered the office of the doctor and ended up killing people who normally would have been healed by those very same medicines.
So who remembers the example of the medicine cabinet? Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi comes back to this. He says this is exactly where they went wrong. If you go back, it's back on in paragraph 79, which we learned not too long ago, but where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi had pointed out this analogy of a fellow who sees a doctor healing a bunch of different people, and he says, well, I can do that too. So he breaks into the clinic of the doctor and starts giving out his own medication, not knowing at all anything about pharmaceuticals, about pharmacology. And he gives out all of these medications haphazardly. He ends up killing most of his patients because he doesn't know what he's doing. And a small percentage of them, he gets it right by coincidence, yeah? So this is what a person who tries to come up using his own rationality, what a person is going to end up doing. You can't get it right unless you know the cosmic fabric of this universe, and there's so much complexity and so much that is hidden from human perception that we can't hope to understand what we're supposed to do on our own. So as much as, you know, interpretive dance may be, you know, the thing that turns you on religiously. You know, you get a spiritual high when you start, you know, dancing, right? But if that's not a mitzvah, it may feel good. It may do something for you emotionally, but it's not going to tap you into the divine. It's not going to tap you into the Almighty, okay? That's really Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's message, that it's not about what's up here, that is what connects me to Hashem, but rather it is a very specific regimented lifestyle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me to do because he knows the pharmacology of this universe. And no matter how satisfying a golden calf may have felt to the Jewish people at the time, it really could not accomplish what Hashem wanted the Jewish people to accomplish as far as becoming close to Him. Okay, anyone want to comment on that? Yes.
And yet, it's interesting that we're not supposed to be drones or robots. There is so much logic involved with following the Torah, and I could see where people would, you know, maybe misapply it.
I think that's an excellent point, right? The opposite of what Rabbi Yehuda, the flip side of the denunciation of the golden calf is not therefore do everything mindlessly, but rather find meaning in the specific regimented lifestyle of a Torah Jew. Find meaning in those commandments and do them while mentally engaged, while emotionally engaged. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I don't believe Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi would disagree with Rabbeinu Bechaya ibn Pakuda, who wrote Chovot HaLevavot, he wrote the duties of the heart, and who said that the physical mitzvahs are like the peel of the fruit, which is the heart, that a person has to be mentally, emotionally engaged in the mitzvahs that he does in order for them to take on their full meaning. Right? I don't think Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi disagrees with that. But he says that mitzvah performance or worship of God that is without the physical specific instructions of the Torah is going to miss the mark completely. Okay.
Rabbi.
Yes.
How our avot manage that, like Abraham, Yitzchak, and Jacob and Joseph without the Torah? I know that they said they know about Torah before Hashem gave us the Torah.
Yes, the Medrash tells us that they observed Kol HaTorah Kula. They observed the entire Torah before it was given. So that's one approach, is that they actually did the mitzvot, and they were able to intuit. They were able to logically conclude what the mitzvot were because of their prophetic powers. But even if you say that they didn't, the Torah had not yet been given. Mm-hmm. So the whole system was different before the giving of the Torah. It was only after the Torah was given that Hashem said, "This is the only way to get to me." Before then, it was possible to connect to Hashem without the mitzvot. Even those commentaries, even the Midrash who says that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov fulfilled all the mitzvot of the Torah, you can't say that the way that they observed the mitzvot was exactly the way we observe the mitzvot today. The Zohar even makes a point of saying that Yaakov Avinu's tefillin were the maklos, were the speckled rods that he placed before the sheep. Now, what that means, I have no idea. But it certainly indicates to you that when we say that Yaakov Avinu wore tefillin, it doesn't mean that he wore the same tefillin that you and I wear, or that I wear. Yeah? Yes?
You look at a mitzvah like kosher, and how simple it was put in the Torah.
Yes.
And yet how complicated it's become.
Yes.
Because of all of the Midrashim and different interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to go in line with what...
With what Yehuda Levi is saying.
Well,
it's funny. I mean, because you know the joke about that, right? God says to Moses, "Moses, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk." And Moses says, "Oh, you want us to have two separate sets of dishes?" And God says, "No, Moses, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk." And Moses says, "You mean you want us to wait 6 hours between milk and flation?" And finally God says, "Do whatever you want." But that of course is a sacrilegious joke, because the reality is that we believe in Torah Sheba'al Peh. We believe in an oral tradition, which is that there's a reason why the Torah writes, "Do not cook a kid in its mother's milk," not once, it writes it three separate times. So when you look at the Torah without an oral tradition, you say, "Oh, well, you know, the Torah writes something three times." The Torah never writes anything arbitrarily or extraneously. The rabbis had a tradition that was given to us at Sinai, given to us from the time that the Torah was transmitted, that there's a reason for three times. Three times means that once to tell you that you can't cook, even without consuming, you're in violation of the Torah. Another one to tell you that you're not allowed to eat it, and another third one to tell you that you're not allowed to even benefit, even without eating it. So then of course you have the rabbinic laws, and we clearly recognize that there are rabbinic laws. Whether or not the rabbinic laws are, and that I think is what you're referring to, Miriam, is that, okay, so what about the law of waiting 6 hours? That's clearly not a Torah law. That's clearly a rabbinic fence around the Torah. Does that conform to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's depiction of a certain cosmic influence that you have every time you observe a mitzvah? Not sure. Not sure whether by waiting 6 hours I'm accomplishing this kind of cosmic, mystical benefit that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is describing. It's possible that he would say that you do, because you know one of the commandments of the Torah is to follow the words of the sages, lo tasur, do not digress from what they tell you right or left. So it's altogether possible that God reconstitutes the cosmos to conform to the rabbinic rulings. But again, that would be conjecture on my part, because we don't see from what he's writing to us now whether rabbinic law fits into this this description that he's describing. But at least Torah law does. Including in the Torah law is the Torah Shebaal Peh, is the oral tradition. Yeah.
So I'm just curious, and again, I'm asking you the kind of conjecture of what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would say. But my understanding, I guess, of one of the problems that we have within our community as a whole is that we are sometimes missing that internal cosmic connection. And you get to a point where people, instead of trying to get that connection, they try to achieve technical proficiency in halacha. It might create chumrah after chumrah after chumrah to do so, and then it doesn't seem to get them any closer, unfortunately, to where they need to be.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, I think the criticism is fair that sometimes people miss the forest for the trees. But from Rabbi Yehuda Levi's standpoint, you don't have to get an emotional high out of what you're doing in order to accomplish what he's describing. If it's like taking medication, if Judaism, if mitzvah performance is like taking medication, then you don't need to know how the medication, you don't have to feel it, you know, go down your tummy and then interact with all of the different organs and the capillaries and blood vessels in your body. If it's working even without your knowledge. And that's one of the that's part of the beauty or the elegance of the way he's describing it, is that when I shake a lulav, I may feel absolutely nothing. So then your question is, well, then why do it? The answer is because you're accomplishing something that's invisible, that's undetectable to any to our senses by shaking that lulav on Sukkos. We don't know how it works, but God knows. It's like taking a medication. It's like taking interferon or whatever chemical you're ingesting. Now, but at the same time, you're right. A person could get lost, on the technical and the minutia. And, but you know what? That's why we have all of the Judaism is multifaceted. We try to make sure that people are well-rounded and balanced in the way that they approach mitzvah performance. There are, however, some people whose personality draws them more to technical stuff, technical halachic observance, and there are other people who are more drawn to more abstract thought, and that aspect of philosophy and ideas and things like that. The thing to appreciate the most, though, is that there's room for everyone at the table, which is the part of the beauty of our faith, that it's not one size fits all. There's a lot of different entryways into the Torah. Okay, so let us go on. So nevertheless, let's continue this text. This is very important. Nevertheless,
the nation's intention was not to depart from serving God. On the contrary, they believed that they were refining their worship of him. This is why they came to Aharon and revealed their desire to him, and this is why he agreed to help them. He was still guilty, though, for transforming their thoughts of rebellion into reality.
Meaning if they really knew what they were doing was sinful, they never would have come to Aharon in the first place and asked him to help them. The fact that they came to Aharon in the first place, who was the second in command to Moshe, means that they genuinely felt that this was desirable to Hashem. Otherwise, they never would have involved Aharon in it. They would have just done it on their own. Aharon complies because he also feels that he's going to try and reveal the sinners and so forth. And we looked at last time whether or not Aharon was ever punished for that crime or not. We saw the Abarbanel a couple weeks ago. Now, and here's really what I wanted to get to today. Let's take a look at number 10. The reason this sin seems so great in our eyes
is because nowadays most nations do not worship images. In those times, however, people were very susceptible because all nations made images for worship. Had their sin been confined to the building of an edifice of their own design for worshiping and focusing on God, for offering sacrifices, and otherwise for honoring him, we would not consider it a terrible crime. That is because today we do build edifices of our own choosing. And we exalt these buildings and draw blessings from them. We might even suggest that the divine presence hovers over these places and that the angels can congregate around them. And were it not for the fact that we need to come together for prayer, this concept would seem foreign. And so it was during the reign of kings in Israel that the leaders protested against religionists who made temples for worship called Bamos. The righteous kings of the time used to destroy them in order to prevent anyone from exalting any building except for the temple that God had chosen and designed. By contrast, the cherubim, sculptures above the ark, were not a foreign concept to them, since God had commanded their construction.
All right, we need to unpack this. There's a lot of important information in this paragraph. But what essentially what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has just told us is that the sin is amplified in our eyes because nowadays most nations do not worship images. So we have lost an appreciation for this kind of worship, this kind of religious worship, where people use physical icons as a form of identifying with their God. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, it certainly gives us a better taste of this when we look at people who come from the Far East and live in our communities and they have a little Buddha statue or another kind of statue in their own home where they regularly place food. I remember I saw this for the first time. I once went to look at a home my wife and I were thinking of purchasing, and we looked and there was in the corner of one of the rooms, there was a little Buddha statue with some food in a plate right in front of it. And I discovered later that this is something that they do regularly. They place food in front of the Buddha statue. That's part of their tradition. This is part of what their religion says. Now, whether or not they believe that the Buddha has influence or not in their lives, I have no idea. I don't know what's in the recesses of their hearts, but this is a vestige of idolatry. And this is a form of taking a physical icon to represent some higher power and to sort of channel that into a physical statue or other graven image. Now, we aren't that far away from idolatry, is really what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is saying. We have buildings today that we attribute godliness and spirituality to. We call that the synagogue. We feel closer to Hashem, spatially even, when we are in the shul. And that is almost, he says, like idolatry. It's not idolatry because God sanctions that kind of worship and that kind of structure. And the things that are considered idolatry, the thing that makes them so terrible is because they're not sanctioned by God. Going back to this original idea that you can only get close to Hashem via the instructions that He gives us. If you trespass the instructions, no matter how good it feels, no matter how intuitively warm and fuzzy that makes you feel, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. Now, this idea that we lack an appreciation today for the practices of old is something that the Gemara touches upon in a few places. The Gemara does tell us that since the first temple's destruction, the desire for idolatry was eradicated, meaning that the rabbis wanted to eradicate all Yetzer Haras. They wanted to eradicate all evil inclination. They tried to banish the Yetzer Hara entirely, the Gemara says. They trapped the Yetzer Hara, it's an Agadata. They stuck the Yetzer Hara in a tube and sealed it off. But there was only one problem. They couldn't find chickens that would lay eggs anymore in Eretz Yisrael. From the northern part down to the south, no chickens were laying eggs. Which means that, what is the Gemara conveying to us? That the Yetzer Hara is a necessary ingredient in the human condition. People would not build homes, would have no ambition, and would not procreate unless the Yetzer Hara existed. And so what the rabbis decided to therefore do was to diminish the Yetzer Hara. So they eradicated the Yetzer Hara for idolatry because they realized the world can continue existing without a Yetzer Hara for idolatry. But they'll retain the Yetzer Hara for other worldly ambitions, including sexuality and things like that. And they therefore allowed the Yetzer Hara to reign in those domains, even though they eradicated the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. Okay? Now, what Chazal are portraying for us can be interpreted in a couple of different ways. The normative way of looking at it is that there was a supernatural phenomena, that the rabbis used some kind of very powerful magic and were able to transform the human psyche from that point forward, so that whereas before people had this tremendous urge to bow down to idols, from that point onwards, people's urges for idolatry ceased to exist. And it was some kind of magic spell that they put over the entire world by banishing the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. But I think that there's a more rational approach to this Agadata, which is that over the course of time, human civilization matures, and it's able to think in a more abstract fashion, and therefore the need for idolatry becomes less and less. That upon the destruction of the temple, mankind had to adapt to a faceless god, and therefore idolatry became less relevant to human society, to human, at least Western human civilization. I want to study a story with you, another story with you in the Gemara. This one is from Tractate Sanhedrin. And I have it for you in English and in Hebrew. It's on the handout that you have in front of you. If you don't have the handout, we have plenty more copies. Yeah?
Question before you leave that topic. Why were the people even punished for the sin of the Chetz Egel if they asked Amaron, and for whatever reason he decided, he said, okay, I'm imagining, let's say nowadays, a group of people would go to the Gadol Hadar and say, can we go jump in the lake, or whatever, and he says, fine. Why
would
he punish them for doing that?
Well, the way that Chazal portray it is that they didn't come and ask him politely in the form of a shayla. They came and they demanded to build the calf. And this is really the way the Torah portrays it as well. Kuma selanu Elohim asher yilchu lefaneinu. Arise, Aaron, make for us a god that will walk before us. Kizeh Moshe ha'ish asher ha'elanu me'eretz Mitzrayim lo yadanu mehayolo. Because this man, Moses, who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. So make for us a god. This was a command that they gave to Aaron. And Aaron felt, you know, Chazal even tell us that they had assassinated Hur, who was Moshe and Aaron's brother-in-law. That he was assassinated because he tried to stop the people. And when Aaron saw this, he said, there's no point in trying to re-educate the masses. They're not in a position right now. There was mob mentality. There was just huge chaos that was about to ensue. Let's take a look at this story together. I'll read it in Hebrew, in Aramaic. Rav Ashi Oki Ashlosha Melachim. There's a tractate in the Tractate Sanhedrin in the last chapter. It talks about three kings of Israel who lost their portion in the world to come. One of those kings was King Menashe. And so, Omar Lamachar Niftach B'Chavrin. So Rav Ashi said, tomorrow, my students, we're going to discuss our buddies. And he was referring to, and in almost like a tongue-in-cheek fashion, he was referring to the kings. These three kings who had worshipped idolatry and who had led the Jewish people astray. He said, well, tomorrow we'll talk about our friends. So, Asa Menashe Ischazele B'Chelme. Menashe comes and appears to him in a dream that night. Amar chavroch v'chaveirai de'avuch karislan. Menashe says to him in the dream, you, Rav Ashi, have the audacity to call me your friend, or even the friend of your father? What a chutzpah. Who do you think you are compared to me? So, mehecha bois l'mishrei hamotzi. And in order to sort of demonstrate to Rav Ashi that Menashe was so superior to him in his Torah knowledge, he said to him, when you have a half a loaf of bread, so just imagine to yourselves, you have a half a loaf of bread that's left over from yesterday's loaf, and it's time for you to break bread and make hamotzi. So he asked him, where in the loaf do you break the bread? Where do you cut your first piece of bread where you're going to make the knife mark for hamotzi. That's what he was asking him. And the reason why he was asking him is, of course, because when you make hamotzi, you're supposed to make hamotzi from the more chashuv, the more important part of the loaf, yes? So what is the more important part of a loaf where you would want to make the bracha on? The Gemara says, Amar le lo yadana. Rav Ashi is conversing in his dream with Menashe, and he tells him, it's a good question, I don't know. Amar le, mehecha deboyis lemishra hamotzi lo gamirt, the chavrach karis lan? So Menashe says, you don't even know a basic halachic question of where the hamotzi bracha is placed, what part of the bread it's placed upon, and you have the chutzpah to call me your friend? Amar le, agmere li, ulamachar darishna le mishmach bepirka. So Rav Ashi says, well, do me a favor, King Menashe, teach me the halacha, and tomorrow when I give shir, I'll teach the halacha in your name. Amar le, mehecha dekarim bishula. And he told him, you make the bracha of hamotzi on the crust, where the bread bakes first, where it forms a crust. So even though you may have a half a loaf of bread, and the white part, we all know, you know, if you just imagine buying that big loaf of white French bread, right? And if you were a chazer by yourself and no one was looking, what would you do? Stick your hand all the way in and pull out all the white and eat that part, right? And then the crust is the, but that's what you would normally think, right? But he says, no, the more important part of the bread, the part that deserves the bracha, is the crust. And that's where you're supposed to make hamotzi from. So Amar le, so Rav Ashi says, it's killing him. He's been humiliated in his dream. So he says to King Menashe, Me'achar dechachimtu kulei hai, my time akopalchisu la'avodazara. He says, if you're so smart and you're such a wise man, King Menashe, you're so learned in Torah, how come you worshipped idols? Your whole career as a king was to worship idols. The Gemara says that Menashe was so dastardly in his idolatry that he would take a Sefer Torah and cut out God's name out of the words, out of the parchment of the Sefer Torah, and replace it with idolatry. So he says, how come you worshipped idols? Amar le, and he said back to him, I havas hasam, havas nakitna bishipule glima verahatas abasroi. If you had been around in my generation, you would have lifted up the hem of your garment to run as quickly as you could after me, to work to bow down to the idols as well. You can't judge me. You didn't live in the time that I lived. You don't know the challenges that I was facing. The Maharal even points out, what does it mean to lift up the hem of your garment? Normally, when you know you're doing an Avera, you welcome impediments. Oh, I hope, sort of like, this is what I want to do, but I hope something will come in my way to stop me from doing the Avera. You would have lifted all the impediments. You would have been so ravenously hungry to worship the idol, you would have been running as quickly as you could to bow down to it first. L'machar amalu l'rabbana niftach b'rabbavasa. The next day, Rav Ashi, when he wakes up, he goes to the Beis Medrash and tells his students, he corrects himself, we're not studying our friends today, we're going to study about our rabbis, our teachers. So this is the conclusion of the story. Now, the story has so much very, very vivid imagery in it about the desire for idolatry. But my question to you is, and I want you to think about this, my question to you is, why did King Menashe ask Rav Ashi about this specific halacha, about the halacha of where you're supposed to make hamotzi from in the loaf of bread? What do you think that is providing us? Why he could have asked him any shaila in halacha. Why did he ask him this specific shaila in halacha? Has anyone ever heard this Gemara before? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So tell me, I want you to think about this. And I want you to tell me what you come up with. Think about this. This is your homework assignment. And I want you to think about why this specific question in halacha was what King Menashe asked Rav Ashi. What's it have to do with the issue at hand, which is Rav Ashi's failure to truly appreciate the desire for idolatry that existed in the times of King Menashe. But one thing you do see from the story, and we will return to this story in Mitzvah Shem next week when we'll try to answer that question. I want to hear what you have to say about it. It takes a while to really let the story settle in and really think about it properly. I'll tell you one second. But one thing you do see from this whole story is that the desire for idolatry back then was far stronger than the desire for idolatry today. And what Rabbi Yehuda Levi is describing is exactly this principle that is illustrated in the Gemara with Menashe, King Menashe and Ravashi. Is that had you been around in those days, you would have had a much greater appreciation for the tremendous desire that the Jews had for a physical icon. And this is all, of course, a part of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's efforts to diminish the severity of the crime that they committed. It's not as bad as we think it is when we read it objectively, because we're placing our own preconceived worldview, our own bias, upon superimposing that upon the story of the Torah. But the story, had you lived during that time, it really wouldn't have seemed like such a dastardly thing as the way that we think about it today. Now, sometimes Chazal do the exact opposite. Sometimes Chazal amplify the severity of an Avera. Because, as we know, Chazal have this principle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu Medakdekim Chasidav Kechut HaSaira, that God is exacting with his saintly ones, like even to a hair's breadth. And that's why sometimes in Tanakh you find that a person commits a relatively minor Avera, and the Torah describes it in very, very strong terms. Chazal thus tell us, for example, that when it says that Reuven slept with his stepmother Bilhah, that's really an exaggeration of what really happened, and that all he did was move his father's bed from one tent to the other. So we see from the eyes of Chazal that sometimes the Torah over-exaggerates the sin because it wants to teach us how important it is for the holy Jewish people never to make a mistake. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would agree with that, and therefore he's just trying to explain to us the flip side. The Torah portrays it in very, very egregious terms, but we have to appreciate that from where the Jewish people were coming from and in the cultural milieu in which they found themselves, this was considered to be a perfectly acceptable and even desirable form of divine worship, and therefore we shouldn't be too hard on them.